Based on some joint work with Renata Renner, and some of the ideas are already contained in this archive paper of a year ago, but there are some interesting extensions which I'll tell you about as well. Okay, so the main kind of focus question that I want you to think about is, are there fundamentally random processes, or what evidence do we have for fundamentally random processes in nature somehow? So if we just imagine that the world is classical, then we would say, well, there are no fundamentally random processes. Anything that looks random can actually be attributed to a lack of knowledge. So in principle, an all-knowing observer who knew everything about the universe at a particular time or could predict what would happen for the rest of the time. Okay, so that's kind of clear. Quantum theory, of course, the answer is somehow yes. So according to the axioms of quantum theory, for example, if I take a plus state, measured in the 0-1 basis, then according to quantum theory, I get a 0 with probability half, I get a 1 with probability half. So you would say, well, in quantum theory, there are fundamentally random processes. But can we really be sure? So, you know, I mean, although the theory says that those processes are random, of course, the question that has been asked many times before is that really the case? You know, could there be some kind of higher theory, some kind of completion of quantum theory that actually helps you to explain the outcomes? Okay, and for a lot of quantum experiments, for example, the one proposed by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, it is actually easy to explain the random outcomes via a hidden variable model. So this kind of inspired the question, you know, can we always do that? And of course, as everyone knows, the answer is no, because this is what Bell later showed. So if you really try to explain all quantum correlations by imagining an underlying classical model, then you can't. Okay, so here's just how I'll state Bell's theorem very quickly. So imagine some I'll just go through this a little bit slowly because this notation will come up again. So here's some device which is going to perform a measurement. And the choice of measurement being performed here is denoted by A, and its outcome is X. Similarly, here's a choice of measurement on some space-like separated particle with B with outcome Y. We imagine this distribution is quantum. Okay, and for Bell's theorem, we also imagine that there's some hidden variable which is in the past of both that somehow is supposed to determine them. And Bell's theorem basically says it cannot be that X and Y are functions only of the locally accessible parameters. So it cannot be that X is a function only of A and lambda, and that Y is a function only of B of lambda. So this cannot be the distribution that we have. Okay, but is that enough? So what are we really looking for? We're really looking for perfectly random processes. And Bell's theorem doesn't actually guarantee that the process is perfectly random. It only says there's no way to predict the outcomes perfectly. So you could imagine that even after Bell's theorem, there is some other, there could still be some kind of hidden variable that, or some other system that tells you more about the outcomes that, according to quantum theory, are completely random. Okay, so Bell's theorem isn't enough to guarantee that the randomness that comes out is completely perfect. And second point is that Bell's theorem is based on certain assumptions. So it's based on this famous locality assumption, which I'll say more about, and also on the assumption that the measurement settings are chosen freely. So this is maybe not so clear in Bell's original paper. It's kind of an implicit assumption here. And this assumption is actually somehow the focus of the later part of this talk. Okay, so the first point is that Bell's theorem actually doesn't need both assumptions, or to say it another way, we can actually guarantee perfect randomness in the outcomes without assuming locality, by just assuming the free measurement settings and the quantum correlations. Okay, so that's actually it's part of the result described in this paper here. So let me just say kind of the result. So it says if A is A is a free measurement. So what does it mean that A is a free measurement? So I haven't really said that yet, but it means that when I choose this measurement setting A, it's uncorrelated with all the kind of distant variables in some sense. So I'll describe this assumption more precisely in a moment, but roughly speaking, for the purpose of this bell type scenario, we have that the probability of A given BY and this lambda is just equal to the probability of A. So in other words, A is uncorrelated with these extra systems. So the kind of main result of this paper is that if A is chosen freely and B is chosen freely, and we have quantum correlations in the outputs, then we can show that the probability of X given A and lambda is just the probability of, I write P of X bar, which is the uniform distribution on X. So in other words, lambda and A actually aren't telling me anything about X. X is just completely, is completely uniform. So this says that, so let me just go back to the statement. So the assumption that the measurement settings are free alone is sufficient to conclude that the outcomes of measurements on EPR pairs are completely unpredictable. Yes?
Well, that also means P of X is a maximum measure, right?
Yes. So it's like, right, so from the... Okay, so now let's go back to this question of whether there are truly random processes. Well, for the purpose of arguing for the existence of truly random processes, this is a little bit unsatisfying because it says that if the measurement settings are free and random, so it's like if A and B are completely free random processes, then so is X. But now if I really want to argue for that these processes exist, so I kind of need them in the beginning before I can conclude them at the end. So it's not satisfying. It's not very satisfying as an answer to the question of whether there are truly random processes. Okay, and this is actually similar to a statement made by Conway and Cochin in their free will theorem, where they essentially the statement is that if the experimentalists have free will, then so do the particles. So that's exactly this. If A and B, these are the things chosen by the experimentalists, if those are free and random, then so are the outcomes, which in Conway and Cochin's language were kind of chosen by the particles. Okay, so the aim of this work is to explore the weakening of this this free choice assumption. Okay, so now, sort of slightly more formally, I'll define what it means for some parameter to be free. So I'll say that X is perfectly free if it is uncorrelated with anything outside its future light cone. Okay, so if we just go back to this freedom condition here, you can see that's exactly what this is. So here's the, if we imagine some, now when we have a variable, we assign it, we can imagine it being created at some space-time location here. So this is supposed to be some kind of space-time diagram. Now when I say that, this condition here is just saying that A is uncorrelated with anything outside its future light cone. So the variables here, lambda, Y, and B, are the ones outside its future light cone. Okay. And so now we also have a sort of notion of a variable being epsilon free. So we say X is epsilon free if its distance to kind of perfectly free is less than epsilon. So where this distance is measured using the variational distance. And so remember that X bar is the uniform distribution on X. Okay, so if X is a bit, then the values that epsilon can take are between 0 and half. And if epsilon is 0, that actually means that these two things are equal, which is the case where X is perfectly free. And the worst case is when X is half, and that means that X is completely determined by lambda. Okay, so let me just sort of give an intuitive notion as to why that should mean X is free. So here's the definition just restated again. So let's imagine X being created here, and these are the kind of light cone or the light rays from X. And here's a bunch of other variables, T, U, V, W. So for U, V, and W, R would be included in this set gamma, and T would not, just to restate the definition. And the intuitive idea to say that X is free, I mean, the idea is basically that X should not be considered free if it's correlated with something in its past. So even though V looks like it's in its future here, there is, of course, a frame in which V is actually occurring before X. And so we would say, well, if you go to that frame, it doesn't really look like X is free anymore. Okay, so that's a kind of intuitive, or that's the kind of intuition behind this definition. Okay, so what is the aim? So the aim is, as the title is, free randomness amplification. And basically, it's the task of making epsilon smaller. So if we have some, we can imagine some source which has some epsilon free bits, and we want to basically make it smaller. So smaller means that it's closer to being perfectly free. And ideally, we would like to make it as close, like arbitrarily close to perfectly free, which actually is what we can do. Okay, so that's what I just said. And the main result is that it's possible for some range of epsilon. So provided we have some guarantee on how correlated or how free this kind of choice bits are, then we can show that the outcome bits are more free, or actually almost perfectly free. Okay, and just to remind you, we don't assume the completeness of quantum mechanics, so this result actually will hold in any non-signaling theory. Okay, so here's sort of how the epsilon-free source looks. So we can now sort of, it's kind of helpful to look at work in an adversarial picture just to imagine what this source can do. So you can imagine you have, someone gives you a box, maybe it's even your brain, you're just trying to choose things at random, but we sort of model it by this box, and this box just spits out bits that look uniform and random and uncorrelated with each other. But actually, what we didn't realize was that this box is actually somehow controlled by an adversary, but the adversary only can control it in a sort of limited way. So what the adversary can do is pick some value, and there's some variable held by the adversary. The adversary can choose some W, and actually that kind of forces, that kind of biases this output bit, but we don't see that. So, for example, the adversary could say, I want this output bit to be zero. And in an epsilon-free source, that means that the probability that this next bit is zero is actually half plus epsilon. Okay? Obviously, because it's only a bit, the other one is half minus epsilon. So the adversary has some way to try and partially influence these bits. But the adversary can always symmetrize their strategy so that we don't notice that. So although these bits are biased, I mean, the adversary can just choose W with probability half, and then we'll never be able to tell them. Okay, so here's the adversarial picture for the whole scenario. So this is kind of a generic protocol for free randomness expansion. So although I'm just going to show it in the bipartite scenario, but in principle, that's just to help the illustration. In principle, there are more parties here. So we have some, so these are the, okay, let's maybe start at the bottom. So the adversary here kind of picks some bit or gets some bit or some variable W, which tells her something about the choices, the apparently free choices that Alice and Bob are going to make. So it kind of gives her a clue as to what A and B might be that she shouldn't have. And then she says, right, given my knowledge of what A and B are going to be, I'm going to create some distribution here, P, X, Y given A, B, W, and I'm going to hand out the kind of A, X part, I'm just going to hand this over to another party. Okay, and now what the other party does is they kind of divide this into the A, the AX part and the BY part, they space-like separate them. Okay, and then they perform their measurements. So they try and choose A, they perform the measurement, they try and choose B, and they check that this distribution is the one that they would expect from quantum theory. Okay. So the first thing to note is that if this W is completely correlated with A and B, then it's easy to recreate any correlations with a deterministic model. So if the adversary knows exactly what your A and B are going to be, then, you know, they can fool you completely. They can make you think that this distribution is quantum when actually it's something completely known to them. Okay, and the second point is that in order that it's in principle possible for there to be perfectly free bits, this distribution that the adversary creates should actually be non-signaling. Okay, so let me just quickly explain that. So basically, there's a connection between non-signaling within the theory and the ability to make free choices. So let's suppose that this variable X conveys some information about B. So actually, so for example, P of X given ABW is not equal to P of X given AW. Okay, so this means that there is some signaling. So this X is actually telling me something about B that shouldn't be allowed if we have no signaling. But then, I mean, basically that means that X and B are correlated in some way. So it cannot be that the distribution of B, given everything outside its future light cone, so that's X, A, and W, it cannot be that that's equal to PB. So it cannot be that B is free. Okay, so that means that if we don't have if there is signaling in the theory, then it's not even possible in principle to make perfectly free bits. So from now on, I'm going to assume that the adversary here has to create non-signaling distributions. Okay. Okay, so now I'll just move on to the results. So we have a positive... So the positive result is as follows. So if we look at some bipartite quantum correlations, and we can prove that provided the partially free initial bits are epsilon free for some value of epsilon, and it turns out that it's like this, then the output bits are arbitrarily free. Okay, so let me just go back to the picture. So it basically means that the adversary can choose your bits with probability about between 0.4 and 0.6. Okay, so if the adversary can choose your supposedly free settings with that range of probabilities, then we can actually prove that X is completely uncorrelated with all the other variables. So in some sense, this is a protocol. That's why we say this is a protocol for free randomness expansion. So this kind of epsilon-free source within this protocol, we can build another source of these bits X, which is it's arbitrarily close to having to being perfectly free, so to making epsilon zero. Okay, and the proof is actually based on chain Bell correlations and their power for a device-independent cryptography. So note that what we do is can be seen as a task in device-independent cryptography. This was first realized by Barrett, Hardy, and Kent in this paper. Okay, so maybe just to sort of explain a small amount about the idea behind the proof. I mean, it turns out, and this is something I won't show, that these correlations... So what are chain Bell correlations? So they're a family of quantum correlations which have the property that X, I mean, these correlations are just so strong that X cannot be correlated with any other variables. Okay. And now we can imagine that if A and B are not free, I mean, what does the adversary really want to do? I mean, the adversary really wants to try to set correlations which look to the person measuring like they are these correlations, but actually they're not. So the adversary, if A and B are not free, then based on the knowledge of A and B, the adversary tries to make the correlations look like they're these perfect Chain-Bell correlations, when actually they're not. Okay, so back to this scenario, the adversary basically says, given my knowledge of A and B, I can send a distribution. I mean, it's now conditioned on this W without being detected. But it just turns out, and this is something I won't show here, that with only a small loss of freedom, the correlations are still strong enough to conclude that X is uncorrelated with the other variables. Okay, so that's somehow the positive result. Okay, here's the negative result. So the negative result is basically that it's more a limitation on these correlations. So it says any technique based on these correlations is limited. And actually we can prove that it fails if epsilon is bigger than 0.15. Okay, so there's some gap where we don't know whether it can be done or not. But essentially to prove this bound, what we have to do is show that the correlations can be explained by a classical model if your level of freedom is bigger than this. Okay, and this is related to the question which has been asked in two papers last year: how much free will is required to demonstrate non-locality? Okay, so it's asking how free the settings have to be such that you can still conclude that you have non-locality in the outcomes. Okay, but really we want to extend this result. So we would like to show that for any value of epsilon not equal to half, so we know that when epsilon is half, we can't do everything. So we'd like to show that if you only have a really, really small amount of freedom when you choose your measurement settings, basically, then epsilon free bits can be amplified to arbitrarily free ones. So this is kind of some directions towards extending this. Okay, so a hint that the higher dimensional systems may allow this comes from the observation that actually epsilon free bits are sufficient to demonstrate non-locality using higher dimensional systems. So this result, how much free will is required to demonstrate non-locality, it looks at bipartite correlations. And for those, I mean, in our case, we have this bound. So if you're not free enough, then with this bound, we can simulate those correlations. But actually, with tripartite correlations, it's much easier to demonstrate non-locality even if you're not completely free. So in order to do this, let's just consider the GHZ correlations. So this is a set of correlations which, okay, it's tripartite, so now I've got an A, B, and a C, and the outcomes, again, are here, X, Y, and Z. Okay, and they have the property that if A, B, and C are, so A, B, and C must be either 0 or 1, they have the property that if they're all 0, the product of the outcomes is minus 1. Okay, the outcomes are either plus or minus 1. Okay, and similarly, if I choose these combinations of A, B, and C values, the product of the outcomes must always be plus 1. Okay, now it turns out that the best classical strategy can only satisfy 3 of these relations. So one particular example of a classical strategy that does that is just if X, Y, and Z are always 1, no matter what the input is, then their product is certainly always 1. So provided A, B, and C take one of these 3 values, we're never going to notice. But of course, if A, B, and C are chosen to all be 0, then that strategy will be noticed. Okay, and actually the best classical strategy. So now let's imagine that A, B, and C are now chosen with some partially free bits. So let's imagine that we're going to try and set up some correlations that try to obey these conditions. But actually, they actually won't. Okay, but we want to make it as unlikely as possible that we get caught cheating. So we're going to hand over some devices to some party. They're going to make these space-like separated measurements choosing these. And we can kind of guess which one of these 4 roughly they're going to choose. Okay, and let's try and minimize our probability of getting caught cheating. So the best classical strategy is to position the unsatisfied relation for the least likely ABC. So the best classical strategy is going to satisfy 3 of these relations. So let's suppose, for example, I know that the least likely one is that they're all 0, because I, they're not completely free. I use my parameter w to say that 0, 0, 0 is the least likely. Okay, so then what I can do is I can just tell these devices just always output 1. Okay, and now I don't get caught with probability 3/4, but I get caught with some slightly smaller probability depending on how free those bits actually were. Okay, so now more generally, there's always one combination which I'm caught. So if I use epsilon free bits to choose this A, B, and C, the probability of the least likely combination is just half minus epsilon cubed. So actually for any epsilon smaller than half, we'll be able to detect non-locality if we did enough measurements. Okay, so these correlations are better in this context somehow than bipartite correlations. Okay, and so this might be a hint that these correlations are good ones for free randomness amplification. Okay, so, but unfortunately, just using the tripartite GHZ correlations is not enough. So actually, although these provide a good way to demonstrate non-locality, just because of that, like in the original Bell case, that doesn't guarantee that the outputs are completely free and random. And in fact, we know for the GHZ case that they're really not. So, for example, one way to recreate these to satisfy all three of these conditions is to just take one of the devices just gives a fixed output, and the other two output according to a non-local box. Okay, now that means that, for example, this output is not completely, and this output's completely known actually by the adversary, if the adversary was the one that set this up. However, here you could say, well, maybe it doesn't matter because if this is a non-local box, then one of these outputs is completely, these outputs are completely unknown. But actually, it turns out you can kind of average out this strategy over all three of the devices. So actually, you can set up a non-signaling distribution such that the output for each of these, for any one of these, can be guessed with probability 2/3. So it kind of spreads this known one among all three. Okay, so then we might sort of use this to speculate that we can improve this by using more systems. So for example, we could take M-party GHZ correlation. So we just extend this to more parties. Okay, now if you do that, it turns out there's still this, I mean, what exactly do I mean by that? I mean, imagine the correlations that are formed by having an M-party GHZ state, and where these measurements are just correspond to measuring either Pauli X or Pauli Y on this M-partite GHZ state. So it's exactly the analog of what I did in the tripartite case, and I just extend this to more parties. Okay, and the hope is that as I increase M, if I then pick a bit, any one bit picked at random from this will be with high probability very close to perfectly free. So unfortunately, there are still these, you might imagine there are still these strategies where one of the outputs is fixed, and these all output according to some kind of more generalized, the extension of a non-local box to more parties kind of strategy. But even if that's the case, once we kind of pick, if we at the end pick one of these at random, it's very, I mean, you might imagine that that the outputs are still very close to being free. So obviously, if we pick the bad one, it doesn't work. But as M gets large, with very high probability, we won't pick the bad one somehow. Okay. So here, in the case where one of them is fixed and these output according to a non-local box, there is kind of a strategy where I spread this fixedness out and get probability 2/3 for each of them individually. So if that, I mean, the hope is that might work again here. So although there's a strategy where one of these is fixed and these are kind of all are some kind of generalized non-local box, one, you might imagine that because there's so many more of them now, that when I do this this spreading out, somehow there's not one that can be there's not too many that can be known with a very high probability. Okay, so actually that's roughly the end. So let me just summarize. So let me just say we don't know whether this works at the moment. So this is an idea towards extending it to the more general case, but of course, we don't have a proof that this works. Okay, so let me just summarize what the main results are. So for initial sources which are sufficiently free, we can generate arbitrarily free bits. So that means that I can take this epsilon down to as small as I want somehow. But although, I mean, this technique is based on the chain Bell correlations, but that technique cannot be extended to all epsilon because at some point we can just use classical, I mean, if your bits are not, initial bits are not free enough, then at some point we can use a classical strategy to simulate them. However, we speculate that there might exist, or that there do exist, quantum correlations which would allow us to take this down. So if so, initial bits with an arbitrarily small amount of freedom would be sufficient to generate new, completely free bits. And that sort of goes back to the original question I asked at the beginning of the talk, sort of what is the evidence for truly random processes within quantum theory? Well, I would argue that that's probably the, if that was the case, that would be the strongest evidence yet for the existence of truly random processes. So what it would sort of show is that if you weren't completely correlated with your, you can imagine now a source of quantum states. It sort of says that if your choices aren't completely correlated with your source of quantum states, so there always remains that loophole. But if there's just a tiny amount of correlation, then actually the outcomes of those measurements are completely uncorrelated with anything, including the thing that set up those quantum states. Okay, so I think that's all to say. Thanks.
So we have plenty of time. Questions or comments?
There was something I didn't understand towards the end when you were talking about generalizations of GHZ to M parties.
Right.
So you said that if you picked the party at random, then you could get it to work. But that seems to run afoul of the desiderata earlier in the talk that you shouldn't be feeding in randomness.
So you can use your partially free source to pick it at random.
So you use the same partially free source that's fixing the settings to pick the party?
Right.
And then so your hope is that if you analyze that, you could still get amplification?
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Well, a while ago it was fashionable to try to do Bell inequality experiments to close the free choice loophole by using astronomical sources of the decision of the setting of the measuring apparatus from opposite directions in the sky, but with the I guess with the success of cosmic inflation and the consequent idea that we're all connected, everything that we can see is connected in the past, it looks like it's really not possible to close this loophole. And all you're saying is that if you have a little bit of randomness, then you can amplify it.
Right.
But if you have none at all, it's probably hopeless.
Yes, that's right. But now the gap is...
I suppose that's the least of our worries. But,
okay, maybe.
More questions or comments?
I was just wondering if you could try to distill randomness before you actually choose the measurement setting, so on the classical level.
So I didn't say this, but if you just have one of these sources that outputs bits that an adversary picks, in computer science this is called a Santa-Vasarani source. And actually it's known that you can't do, if you only have that as a resource, any classical function you do, even if you map to just one bit, you cannot improve the amount of randomness you have there. You cannot make stronger randomness by doing a classical function.
More questions? So if there are not any more questions, then let's thank Roger again.